This is Matt Wells at UN News. Fighting's ongoing in Ethiopia's Tigray, where the level of cruelty against women and children is incomprehensible and likely vastly underreported. That's the disturbing assessment of the UN Children's Fund UNICEF, which is deeply concerned for the more than 1 million people displaced by 6 months of violence. Just back from the conflict zone, here's the latest from UNICEF spokesperson James Elder, who's been talking to UN News' Daniel Johnson.
I think the latest from Tigray is that the situation is not improving, that there's just so many people who've lost so much, and it's still an active conflict zone. So you've got either people who are sheltering, people who are still caught in the crossfire, or people who are suffering violations because this is a conflict zone and there is looting and there is sexual violence. It's an awful time, an awful place for kids.
It sounds horrendous. 6 months since fighting started, isn't it? And fighting is still going on. I mean, are reports of 250,000 opposition fighters to be believed? Is there any sign of them?
Look, based on uniform and language and based on speaking to people, certainly I constantly reinforce that it's a multitude of armed actors. I would have to say that. And security and access, you know, remain serious issues. And organizations like UNICEF feel that we know the response that is needed, but those security issues, and I can talk a little bit about things that have happened very recently to our quite incredible mobile health and nutrition teams, but those security issues, you know, remain serious blockades to us reaching so many kids who 6 months ago were living a pretty normal life.
Tell me about some of those stories then, some of the victims. I know in an earlier press conference you mentioned one girl who walked 300 kilometres on foot.
Yeah, there's so many things that are so startling and on one hand so heartbreaking, and at the other side such testimonies to what people will endure. The little girl was 16 years old. She had four siblings, and they, you know, her brother and father had been caught in the fighting in the west of the country, and the family fled without them. And she went 300 kilometres and in broken flip-flops, carrying her little brother on her back. I mean, she says all this, you know, not to create sympathy, but just because this has been her story. Only support she got on the way was from any communities, anyone that could give them anything, but obviously they didn't. They went days and days without food. She said she saw so many dead bodies. And obviously that was something she hadn't endured previously. And now, of course, was like so many of these kids, desperately looking for some support. They're the children UNICEF is seeking to help. But as I say, there's such a huge number at the moment, such a breadth of need, so many kids out of school, so many kids facing nutrition crises, so many water systems are smashed, you know, we have a pretty incredible response right now. It's up to sort of 600,000 plus people reached with safe water. But again, security, law and order, these things are really critical to enable our response to reach all the children, like that little girl, Meriwet, who I met. Those are the children that need support. But again, to do that, we've got to see an end to looting. We've got to see an end to violence. We've got to see, unfettered access. Because at the moment you have a potential nutrition crisis. These people, remembering it, I mean, it was some really good agricultural setups, some really modern water systems. But the conflict started in November. That was the time to harvest. That was the moment that people would have actually been getting their crop for a year, which is food and a cash crop, food and income for the next 12 months. They didn't get that. Now they can't plant. These things are obviously really, really worrying for UNICEF and in many other UN agencies. Yes. This is the crisis we're looking at.
Yes. Who is doing this looting?
Well, again, I don't think there's a single force, but when you're in the west of the country, and there was certainly a discussion there about Eritrean forces, and we now know that Eritrean forces have been in the country, are probably still there, when you're listening to senior UN officials like Mark Lowcock. So again, for anyone I spoke to, based on uniform and language, it was a multitude, and it's not, you know, not UNICEF to I don't have that data, but definitely there was multiple accusations based on language, but this was some of those forces who were invited into the country.
Let's just go back to the young girl, the 16-year-old Mary, who you mentioned. Where is she now?
So she's now about 100 kilometres. She ultimately went 500 Ks. The last 200 kilometres she was transported. She was in a bus. So she's now in an IDP, in a settlement for displaced people, about 100 kilometres from the capital. We're looking to get her at least into a temporary learning space. Now, this is another child. She's really clever, hey? Her favourite subject, she didn't want to be a teacher or a doctor. Her favourite subject was physics. She explained to me how she used to make things. She liked innovation. They were her words. I like innovating. And she, you know, used before old magnets and bits of scrap metal and so on. And she used to make, you know, electric trucks and so on. So a really, really clever girl. And she was out there. She sought us out. So, you know, these are really proactive, strong, brave kids, but they're having to do things that, you know, adults would hope never encounter in their lives.
Sure. And you also have recorded a lot of reports of gender-based violence, sexual attacks, hopefully not against children, but very likely. What does UNICEF do with this information?
Well, we do a couple of, I mean, yeah, they were harrowing, I have to say. I mean, you know, conflict has always dealt really cruelly with women and kids. But in situations like this one, where fighting is so often taking place, not in a battleground, but it's where people live. And so, you know, civilians, women and girls, are then being, you know, targeted, direct targets of this violence. And some of the level of cruelty was just, was incomprehensible, I have to say, before going into what UNICEF does. But we have a large range of response. So firstly, yes, we do report these things. We keep records and so on and so forth, so people's stories are told. These are very brave people. We also know that this is probably a tip of an iceberg. It's very difficult to report. It's difficult culturally. It's difficult because there's a conflict. It's difficult because transport is expensive and often you can't get that transport. And then as a response, what do we do? Well, UNICEF provides medical assistance, psychological assistance, things like dignity kits, which come with various things that women need. But more resources are needed. But that's very, very clear. You need law and order. We need unhindered access. We need more mental and psychosocial support for people, more capacity to address this kind of conflict-related trauma. And, of course, I guess, first and foremost, you know, authorities need to publicly denounce these attacks, perpetrators of sexual violence during armed conflict are violating international law. So they must be held accountable, and then there must be resources so victims can seek justice.
Yes, and that's really important for victims, of course, and for people to be able to get back to their lives. Unfortunately, as you say, some very, very expensive water irrigation systems have been totally smashed, as have hospitals. People are not at school. We haven't even spoken about that. But I guess for the moment, the security is the biggest issue. What's your access actually like there? I mean, is there also internet access for people?
The access is a mix. As I say, officially, you know, it's full access, and it's definitely better than a couple of months ago, no doubt. But we are into the sixth month of something that's displaced, you know, upwards of a million people. So the access is theoretically always there, but on the ground, no, there will be days where you can't go to an area you need to go to. And that's really critical when you look at some of the report that we're actually talking about. I mean, for example, because as you rightly mentioned, we've seen so many health centres and hospitals damaged or looted. And here I talk of, you know, I saw a health clinic that was state of the art, built last year, operating ward for emergency C-sections and so on, and had just been totally turned upside down. So what UNICEF had done, we've supported partners to kickstart about 22 of these mobile health and nutrition teams. These are frontline, you know, physicians and trained workers who are reaching tens of thousands of kids in some of the most difficult areas. And that's everything from severe malnutrition to helping a woman if she needs to give birth. They go 6 days a week, and the seventh day they restock. They are a really amazing force of what can be done with brave, well-stocked people. But I heard just today that in the last sort of 2 weeks, UNICEF has received reports of at least 16 incidents involving these health and nutrition mobile teams, where they've had to leave because of fighting, because of direct threat, because of literally death threats, where they've been forcibly relocated to other locations. So, you know, you can only do so much. You have well-stocked, well-trained, brilliant, brave teams, and then, you know, at gunpoint, they're forced to go somewhere else and not serve the community they're seeking to help.
Last few questions quickly, if I may, James Elder from UNICEF. Have you ever seen anything like this?
Yeah, I mean, sadly, yes, without a doubt. I was in Sri Lanka. That was probably even more harrowing, but I can't compare any one of these individual stories. The early days of South Sudan, there was, you know, not enough attention likely given, and we saw how badly that spiraled for a population. So there are certainly some parallels. Again, every single person there is just trying to live out their own story and make due. And I guess part of the parallels are, again, I'm reminded time and again by the heroics of individuals and their communities. But on a bigger scale, yeah, most recently for me at least, seeing a lack of international attention on South Sudan and seeing what was happening to so many people going into the 6-7 figures. Unfortunately, that brings back memories of that, certainly.
But staying with South Sudan, you're not suggesting it might deteriorate to that extent?
No, of course. I mean, I talk here just of Tigray, what I saw there. And of course, I'm comparing in some ways apples to orange because I'm talking of one area, one state of Ethiopia versus what became, well, eventually became much of South Sudan. But again, for individual stories and just to see what people are enduring and to see what's happening at the hands of some armed forces and therefore a lack of international attention given the scope of it, then those parallels felt okay.
Thanks, James. What does UNICEF need, the UN Children's Fund need, to restore people's chances of a decent future?
I think two things. One is that unfettered access, because based on our response at the moment with those mobile health teams, with water, with setting up education systems, we do know what needs to be done. We are doing that on a pretty big scale right now, but it's only law and order and unfettered safe access that lets us reach every single person who needs it. And then of course it comes down as well, you know, rebuilding water systems is not cheap. UNICEF Ethiopia's appeal for Tigray stands at about $47 million, and less than half of that is funded. That's difficult when you see colleagues on the ground who are doing 7 days a week, and you know sometimes their own efforts are being restricted because there are fiscal restraints. So, you know, funding is always required for us to reach those kids who are, again, enduring things that we wish never, ever happened to children.